Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We are going to be taking stock of something that went down in Washington, D.C. this week, the State of the Union Address. I've actually been thinking of it more as the state of Biden's disunion. Because what he has been doing to our country ever since he got office, and we can talk about the legitimacy of how he did it, but certainly he defrauded the American people by characterizing what he would do as unifying us, pulling us together, making us stronger, building us back. I think it's been anything but that. And as I expected, he largely lied about his record and about his ambitions. And certainly about the kind of unity that he is bringing about in our country. We're going to talk about all of this, State of the Union Address, and much more, with one of our brainiacs here at Securing America. He is what I call our duty genius, as a matter of fact, a Mensa Society member. So don't take our word for it. It's absolutely true. His name is George Raisley. He is these days the editor-in-chief of a wonderful resource, Richard Viguerie's Conservative HQ, brings to this particular portfolio a wealth of experience. Political life, some 300 campaigns have benefited from his involvement, including many of them at the presidential level. He has served at the top of our food chain in politics, in the office of the Vice President of the United States for a time, also on Capitol Hill. He is a man, in short, who knows his way around the Mondo Politico, as it's called, the political world, and much more. And we're always delighted to have him with us. George Raisley, welcome back to Securing America.
Thank you, Frank.
So, overall impressions of the State of the Union Address. I trust you stayed up late last night to take it all aboard.
Yes, in an act of self-flagellation, I stayed up and watched it. And
I think of it as public service, George, especially okay, your commentary on it now.
The my overall impression was one that alleged President Biden wants to be both the fireman and the arsonist. And, you know, he reeled off a litany of alleged accomplishments. And of course, all the dragons that he claimed to have slain were ones that he loosed upon the country. you know, the insecure border, the disastrous economic policies that caused, you know, millions of Americans to be thrown out of their jobs, the ongoing, inflation, et cetera, et cetera. And so basically every problem that he claimed to be solving or to have solved is a problem that he and or congressional Democrats created. And so this is a nice gig if you can get away with it in anything. You know, imagine a business that was built on the idea that you're going to wreck some sector of the economy and then sell people the solution to that destruction. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, and it seems to be part of the playbook, unfortunately, of the left these days, doesn't it? George, one of the things that was a clearly very conscious refrain is that something along the lines of we've got to finish the job. Presumably, this is part and parcel of his putative interest in running for re-election. And that will give him a mandate to finish the job. I have to say, based on what I've seen, it's more a question of whether he'll be able to finish off America. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. Well, you talked about the border. You've talked about what he's been doing to the economy. It, as is always the case, I guess, whether it's a Republican or it's a Democrat, these State of the Union addresses turn into this litany of promises of free stuff. Basically, all kinds of goodies and new programs and special interest, benefits and so on. Are we at a point now where really the question of whether there's an America left when he's done with it is in order to discuss?
Yeah, that's a fair question, Frank. And I think the answer is, I don't think the country can handle six more years of Joe Biden. And, you can pick a sector of the economy or our polity. And if it hasn't been wrecked already, it's well on the way. And the litany of free stuff is interesting. I mean, this is a playbook that goes back to ancient Athens, in which the the rulers early on figured out that they could bribe the voters with their own money. And so that's what's going on here. And it's gotten worse and worse. I mean, it's gotten, imagine JFK saying, well, everybody's going to get a free phone if you vote for me. It's unthinkable that Democrats just, two generations back were strong on national defense, had a vision of how to grow the economy, et cetera, et cetera. And Biden is doing practically, 180 degrees opposite of what any rational political operator would do if those were their goals.
Right. Well, I want to come back to that point, George, but just a personal insight. I cut my teeth as a young staffer working for a Democrat in the John F. Kennedy mold, Scoop Jackson.
Yeah.
And I often think about the high RPM rate at which he must be spinning in his grave, as would be John Kennedy and others, Harry Truman, at what has become of their party. But again, to your point, what we're seeing is a question of if they're not serving the best interests of our country, whose interests are Joe Biden's principal intended beneficiaries?
Well, it's hard to imagine an interest that aligns with our traditional constitutional republic that is served by any of this. So if you ask yourself, which foreign actors benefit, clearly the major beneficiary is Red China. They are our number one adversary. Much of what Biden has done has accrued to their benefit. We know that he is financially compromised, if not compromised on an intelligence level, with by Red China because of his son's vast business interests there and the uncounted millions that went through Hunter's crack pipe while Joe was vice president. And that's my, the Red Chinese are my number one beneficiary if I were to make a hierarchy of.
Yeah. I love the fact that you're calling them Red China because, for too long it's just been China or it's the People's Republic or even Communist China is, I think, coming back a bit. But Red China, of course, captures the communist character and revolutionary danger. And you couldn't be more right, of course, George, as we document here and at our Present Danger China site, the mortal peril, the existential threat that these guys represent. We'll talk about that and more with George Risley on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last night, Joe Biden reprised in the Capitol the false narrative that election deniers brought us an insurrection there aimed at overthrowing our government. The president neglected to mention that his administration is simultaneously intervening in Israel to support leftists denying the results of the election that brought Bibi Netanyahu back to power, with a mandate to reform an unaccountable and anti-democratic judiciary. Neither did he acknowledge that those leftists are now openly calling for civil war, the overthrow of the Israeli government, and even the assassination of Prime Minister Netanyahu. A Center for Security Policy briefing yesterday revealed that Team Biden is threatening to abandon the Jewish state to a nuclear Iran unless Netanyahu reneges on his commitment to Israeli voters to restore historic limitations on the power of their Supreme Court. Democracy needs accountable government in Israel and here. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're visiting with one of our duty experts on matters political as well as strategic. His name is George Raisley. He is the editor-in-chief of Richard Viguerie's newsletter entitled Conservative HQ. George, you were talking about China, Red China, to be precise, being the principal beneficiary of a lot of what Joe Biden does. In fact, it's my line that, you know, everything that he does has basically been bad for America. Mm-hmm. And it does seem as though it's been pretty much good for China. To the extent that that's the case, I'd ask you to put into the context of his compromise. Well, compromise by, but betrayal on behalf of China. This whole episode with the balloon, what did you make of it, and what are the principal takeaways, do you think?
Well, that's the balloon has got to be one of the more bizarre national security breaches that we've had in decades. You know, this was seen by our early warning system before it ever reached America. It crossed over vast stretches of the country that are virtually uninhabited, in Alaska, for example. It crossed over many important military installations, you know, our northern tier missile silos, for example. It then
the strategic deterrent to China.
Yeah. It then passed through essentially the entire American heartland before Biden finally got around to shooting it down over the ocean, where it will be difficult to retrieve and analyze the package that the balloon was toting. So,
though it is evidently the case that the Navy is grabbing what they are finding there.
They're working
on finding everything of interest. And there's an enormous expense associated with all this that probably would not have been if it were brought down over land. No?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a great training exercise for our Navy divers and, you know, deep water recovery folks, although I guess it's not that deep, but it's still
50 feet.
Yeah.
So, but George, the point that I guess I'd be interested in is your mm-hmm. observation that this had more to do probably in the mind of the Chinese, particularly mm-hmm. the timing of this, than just with engaging in surveillance of sensitive sites across our country, or even just demonstrating that they could fly a balloon over our country in this fashion. What else do you think is going on in the mind of a guy like Xi Jinping, who was supposed to be, during this period, we're told, meeting with our Secretary of State?
For example. It was it was a big middle finger to Blinken, And in essence, you know, Biden, at first, you know, the Biden administration said they were postponing the visit in view of this incursion. And then I guess it's now been canceled for however long they're going to cancel it. But I mean, there's also another aspect of this, which is they're probing our defenses, because this wasn't just an intelligence gathering operation in the sense that they were picking up electronic communications or stuff like that. I mean, the balloon could have delivered an EMP or any other kind of weapon that they chose to put on it. And to the extent that they now have some sense of when we picked it up, what we're going to do or not do, our ability to probe it and see if it had anything threatening in it. They now know a lot that would be beneficial if they decided to attack us.
Yeah. George, you said at first, Biden was, postponing this deal with, the Kowtow trip is how I kind of think of it for Tony Blinken to Beijing. Mm-hmm. But before that, their policy was to suppress any information about this overflight. They didn't want, apparently, to jeopardize that meeting and the opportunity, presumably, in the State of the Union address to claim that they'd had some sort of great breakthrough with China. Okay. And obviously that didn't happen. But do you think that was going on? And if so, again, does this play into the perception on the part of the Chinese that they can have their way with Joe Biden and his team?
Well, that's a very good point, Frank. And, you know, we have to recognize that the balloon was not acknowledged until it was over Montana and a local newspaper printed a picture of it. And so I think it's a very reasonable conclusion to draw that they were sitting on the information in the hopes that the Blinken meeting could proceed and that they wouldn't have to call the Chinese out on this very serious incursion into our sovereignty.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting. A friend of mine sent, you know, there's been a lot of great memes that have come out of all of this. But I saw one today that had a picture of Xi Jinping on the phone and beneath him another picture of Joe Biden on the phone. And the wording under Xi's picture is, you can shoot it down now. We got what we needed.
Yeah.
And Biden's lettering is, okay, boss, I'm on it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I don't know that that's too far off the mark, actually. It's a case of art imitating life, I guess. But one other piece of this that I'd like to get your thoughts on, George, and that is in the State of the Union address, to the extent that the president talked about China at all, aside from very misleadingly suggesting that, you know, now that he's on the case, China's no longer rising and we're no longer in decline, which I consider to be an act of gaslighting of the first order.
It's a polite way of putting it.
Wishful thinking at best. But he also really framed the whole relationship as just this competition. We're going to try to compete better, and you know, they're going to be on notice that we're going to be competitors. We don't want any conflict, mind you, but we're going to be competing. What do you make of that, George?
Well, this, you know, that is an attitude that is all too prevalent in the higher echelons of American politics, and it's mostly on the Democrat side, but there are also Republicans or people who are, you know, Chamber of Commerce Republicans, if you will, that don't see Red China as an existential threat. They see them as the guys who, you know, produce our Christmas tchotchkes and make consumer goods cheaper for Americans. And so we ought to thank them for that. We ought to get along with them. And to the extent that they're siphoning trillions of dollars out of our economy into theirs doesn't seem to bother these guys. And of course, those trillions of dollars go to the Red Chinese military. That's where they're getting the money to build their fifth and sixth generation fighters, their new Blue Water Navy, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, their Belt and Road Initiative, their subversion, their unrestricted warfare against us, on and on. And George, I'm heartened by your comment that there are a relatively small number of Republican sort of Chamber of Commerce types. Mitch McConnell comes to mind, unfortunately, a prominent one.
Another compromise guy.
But if that's true, it's a relatively recent development. And we have to take another break. And when we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit about that evolution in the thinking, at least within some circles in the Republican ranks, that China is not just a business opportunity. China is not just a source of things that we can get cheaper than we can get them from other places, including manufacturing them here. China is really just our partner, competitor perhaps, but partner mostly. That's a sea change, and we need to find out what's going on with it right after this with George Raceley.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with George Raceley, a man of very considerable experience in the political arena. He has served on some 300 campaigns over his career. He is also, these days, working with one of the great conservative leaders of our time. Well, most time, actually, for many, many decades, Richard Viguerie, where he edits Richard's wonderful online resource, Conservative HQ. George, you were saying before the break that mostly Democrats are still blind to the danger that we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party. You acknowledge that some Republicans still sort of cling to this idea that, you know, they are the next big thing in terms of how we can make money and where we can get goods from and so on. Chamber of Commerce Republicans, I think, is the way you describe them.
Yeah.
If that's true, I hope you're right, but if it's true, first of all, there are a significant number of people who fall into that category, and notably echelon upon echelon of Wall Street mavens. Yeah. But it would also suggest, if it is true, that we've seen the scales falling from the eyes for an awful lot of other people. I'd like to think that our Committee on the Present Danger of China, of which you are an important member, is helping in that regard. But what other evidence would you point to that's the case? Because it has to be. And more to the point, it has to be that that's translating into, you know, the political arena as well, notably with this new Congress.
Yeah. Well, Frank, I would suggest that this is in substantial way a bottom-up process. We have individual states, for example, looking at legislation to prohibit the Red Chinese from buying land in that state. We have big phone campaigns, letter writing campaigns, emailing campaigns coming from the grassroots to Congress saying, you know, don't let the Red Chinese access our Wall Street financial markets. Don't let them have their way in other regards. And so it's an education process in which, you know, members of Congress have a lot on their plate. And there are lots of threats out there. They don't walk into their new offices when they're elected with perfect knowledge of anything. And to the extent that organizations like the Committee on the Present Danger and others have raised these concerns at the grassroots level, members of Congress are becoming more and more educated, if for no other reason than political self-preservation. You know, if you got thousands, if not millions, of Americans telling their members of Congress, this is a problem and we want you to do something about it, then suddenly Red China becomes a lot more important than, you know, pick another important issue. And so that's a big piece of the puzzle, is this grassroots action to, in essence, force members of Congress to become knowledgeable and to pay attention and to move this up the hierarchy of issues that need to be dealt with.
Yeah. George, that's so encouraging. And I think you're right. It certainly is our purpose to try to ensure that you're right. One of the things that I just wanted to say is you and I were both very critical of Speaker Kevin McCarthy and his leadership, his ambition to become speaker, let me be precise. He has clearly tried to signal in both the election for that job as well as in its aftermath that he's supporting efforts by the several committees, including a new one, a select committee on China, to get much more granularly clear about what the Chinese are up to and what we need to be doing about it. I do think, and I want to come back to this point about Wall Street, you touched on it, and I think properly so, a critical test of whether he means it and whether the Congress will in fact get its arms around the danger that we're facing from this quarter, Red China, as you put it, is whether we'll be able to follow the money, our money, that continues to be sent by Wall Street to China. In fact, it seems to be on an uptick again after some rather rough country. But George, I'd be interested in your thoughts about that as a political matter. You understand the fundraising dynamic and how all this works when the lobbyists say don't even think about doing that, whether the speaker will not permit anybody to think about doing that.
Well, I've been pleasantly surprised and encouraged at Kevin McCarthy's early actions. I think he got the message from the Freedom Caucus and others in the rules package that was passed was a great start. It remains to be seen whether this translates into real action. There are two kinds of bills, well, three kinds of bills. There are bills that don't really do anything but make people feel good, like naming a post office. There are bills that are so-called messaging bills, which have a good message behind them, but are and once passed, they're dead. They're not going any place in the Senate, not getting signed by the president. And then there are must-pass bills. And so, and those would be, for example, you know, the budget. So it remains to be seen if the speaker will allow anything that addresses, for example, Red China's access to Wall Street in one of these must-pass bills. If it's a messaging bill, a standalone bill that passes the House, might even get a few Democrat votes, but it's going no place in the Senate, then we know that the speaker isn't really serious about this. If, on the other hand, this bill could be combined with something that, quote, must pass, end of quote, then that's serious.
Yeah.
And so,
George, as you know better than I, something that precedes that, presumably, at least if there's any semblance of regular order, as they call it, are hearings to get into why must pass legislation needs to have something directing Wall Street to stop putting our money in the hands of our mortal enemy. And I hope we'll see an early test of that. Mike Gallagher's Select Committee on China, and maybe Chris Smith's committee that commission on China that involves both the executive and the legislative branch, and maybe some of these other committees as well. But we'll be watching that closely. I did want to turn to one other thing before we have to let you go, George, and that is, you are a gun guy, I think it's fair to say. A proud member of the NRA for many years. You're an instructor, actually, I think, for the NRA. You know your way around firearms and efforts to control firearms, so-called gun control initiatives of various sorts. You've been writing recently about a new gambit that the administration is seeking. Biden passionately spoke about how important it was that he stopped so-called assault weapons from being purchased for a time. Talk about both his record and what you're warning about now is in the offing.
Well, you know, Biden throughout his entire career has tried to limit American Second Amendment rights. And, you know, Democrats generally want to put gun ownership in the same category as getting a driver's license or something like this. I'd note for the record that driver's licenses aren't in the Constitution. And more to the point, why do we have a Second Amendment? Well, it isn't to permit Americans to go hunting or anything like that. So if you read it closely, there's a clause that says for the preservation of a free state. And so to the extent that...
So it's not even just self-defense. It's to assure that the government does not get out of hand.
Yeah. And that we Americans remain in a state of freedom. And so... This is part and parcel of the Democrats' long march to make individual citizens dependent upon the government for everything. They want you to be dependent on the government for your medical care, for your phone, for your self-defense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so to the extent that they want to render us into government-dependent drones, the final step in that process is to disarm us.
Yeah. Well, or it may not be the final one, but it's certainly going to be one that drives us in that direction irreversibly, I fear. And I think that what you have been doing with the NRA and others who are standing for gun rights are doing is so vital and clear need at a moment like this where the government is interested in controlling us more and more at the expense of all of our constitutional freedoms, not just the Second Amendment. George Raisley, thank you for the work you do at Conservative HQ, for your participation in our programs at the Committee on the Present Danger China, and of course in these as well. We'll have you back soon.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Today. We'll speak with Robert Spencer next about Well, Israel, among other things, right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back. And we're back with one of my favorite people. His name is Robert Spencer. He is the director of an extraordinarily important online resource, jihadwatch.org, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He is the author of, well, I've lost count of how many books. I think it's 24, but that was yesterday, so it's probably 25 today. Among them, many really important ones on the truth about Muhammad and Sharia and jihad and not least Afghanistan, the subject of his most recent book for the Center for Security Policy Press, Who Lost Afghanistan? We're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him, and this is no exception. Robert, welcome back to Securing America. Good to have you with
us. Thank you very much, Frank.
I wanted to start with the subject of a really important webinar we did this week. It was a briefing, really, by two of our best folks. You know them both, I think, well. Carolyn Glick, a American now naturalized citizen of Israel, formerly worked for Benjamin Netanyahu and is at the forefront, really, in the public policy debate. Her now native land. And with David Wormser, my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, as are you, one of our senior fellows, as is Carolyn for that matter. The subject was something that I think is going completely unremarked. It didn't feature in Joe Biden's State of the Union address, that's for sure. And it goes like this, even as he is caviling about the election deniers who sought to, anti-democratically incite an insurrection in the Capitol 2 years ago, Joe Biden's team is encouraging, no kidding, election deniers in the state of Israel who are engaged in anti-democratic behavior, namely the completely unrepresentative and unaccountable Supreme Court of Israel's running amok, including completely defying the will of the voters of Israel, who just recently elected Benjamin Netanyahu to govern once again, and who are now threatening many of the proponents of all of this in Israel, not just the overthrow of the government of Israel, but a, quote, civil war, unquote, and some are even calling for the assassination of Benjamin Netanyahu unless he reneges on his promises that got him a mandate from the Israeli people to engage in judicial reform. I'm not sure how closely you've been following all this, Robert, but I'd like to get your reaction to the idea that our government, first of all, would be intervening so directly and dangerously in the internal affairs of an important ally, and be doing so in such a hypocritical fashion, especially when judicial reform clearly is needed in Israel, and we must offset whatever the Biden team has in mind in that regard here, notably packing the Supreme Court. Over to you, sir.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Frank, to note that even whatever the status of judicial reform in Israel, that's really up to the government of Israel. And we should not be interfering in their internal affairs in the first place. But the Biden administration is indeed outstandingly hypocritical. It uses its fake insurrection narrative of January 6th to try to discredit and ultimately destroy its legitimate opposition in the United States. And meanwhile, it's also trying to destroy the opposition to its policies, the policies that is that the that it wants the government of Israel to adopt. And so the previous government of Prime Minister Yair Lapid was in line with the Biden administration's agenda of appeasing the Palestinian Arabs, of restoring the aid to them despite their support for jihad terror, and so on. And so that's the kind of government that the Biden administration wants in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, but not the Netanyahu government that would stand up to the Palestinians and was much more in line with Trump's holding the Palestinians accountable and cutting off their aid because of their support for terrorism in accord with the Taylor Force Act. But now Biden is showing, or Biden's people are showing, that they're completely unscrupulous in this and are willing to resort to underhanded measures, which really shouldn't surprise us since they've fabricated the whole January 6th narrative domestically.
Indeed, they did. Robert, you follow closely at Jihad Watch, of course, of the machinations of the Muslim Brotherhood and their penetration into and influence over this administration. Do you think there might be something in the way of a correlation there between that influence and what this administration is doing towards
Yes.
Israel, including not least this this judicial reform business, but more generally on the Palestinian account, especially you might want to mention Tony Blinken's visit there, Jake Sullivan's, and for that matter, William Burns in these regards.
Well, you know, Blinken, of course, went over to try to call to try to strong arm the Israeli government into going along with the appeasement of the Palestinians. Hadi Amr is a high level official in the Biden administration who is a Muslim who is linked to the Muslim Brotherhood organizations and who has spoken out very clearly for years in support of the Palestinian jihad against Israel. And he's one of the primary representatives of the U.S. government in its relationship with the government of Israel. And so he's going to be completely one-sided in his analysis and his recommendations regarding the conflict.
Yeah. And the bottom line of that will be, I fear, not only further strains in the relationship between our governments, but also possibly really endangering one of our most important, if not the most important, certainly in the region, our most important ally at a very dangerous time. And you know, one of the things that Blinken and Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, probably William Burns, the CIA director, all were sort of conveying, Blinken for sure, the others I suspect, to Benjamin Netanyahu was that if he does not renege on the promises he made, as I said, to the voters of Israel, which gave him a mandate for reforming the judiciary. Robert Spencer, hold the thought. We want to get more into this idea of not only breathing new life into this very bad deal, but also legitimating, propping up, and otherwise emboldening one of the most dangerous regimes on the planet. We'll be right back with Robert Spencer right after this. Welcome back. We're visiting with one of the great thinkers and chroniclers and analysts of the challenges that we're facing from what I call the red-green axis, the red of the left, the green of the jihadis. And he chronicles their doings and offers insights into what it might mean for the rest of us, famously, at jihadwatch.org. His name is Robert Spencer. We're always delighted to have him with us. I commend to all of you, especially one of his most recent books. I think there's probably a new one or two out since this one came out a month or two ago, Who Lost Afghanistan, but we'll talk about that more in a moment. Robert, you are discussing this effort by oligarchs in the United States using their funds, I guess directly, but certainly through cutouts like the National Iranian-American Council, which, as I recall, the Iranian regime itself has described in some of its propaganda outlets as the Iran lobby, to say nothing of J Street and others, to try to encourage our government to make further concessions to the Iranian regime in the interest of getting some new piece of paper that wouldn't be worth the paper that it's written on, a new nuclear deal. What's up with this, and what are the implications if it winds up not only, you know, in fact, breathing new life into this very dubious proposition, but also helping prop up this regime that the people of Iran don't want to lead them any longer?
Indeed, Frank, if the deal were to go through, the Iranian regime would immediately receive $7 billion, and then it would receive billions more in additional sanctions relief after that. And so the deal itself would prop up the regime. There wouldn't be any other motion needed to prop up the regime. The conclusion of the deal would do that. But the leftist oligarchs in the United States and Europe very much want this. They want the Iranian regime to be there. They have business interests there. And also for the Biden administration, it's a matter of saving face. After Obama made this deal the centerpiece of his foreign policy, and then Trump repudiated it and called it a bad deal, the Biden team, which is very largely the Obama team, wants to, in a certain sense, vindicate their previous action and show up, in their mind, the previous administration by restoring the Iran deal. But it would be catastrophic for the region, for Israel in particular, and for the United States as well.
Yeah. And what would it do, Robert, it just actually being engaged in such talks with the Iranian mullahs, to the people who are seeking their removal from power, the millions who've gone into the streets, some of them being killed now for doing so?
It signals to the Iranian people that the United States, still the foremost nation of the free world, is not behind them, does not support their efforts, and will not be with them if it comes down to a large-scale crackdown within Iran. The United States government ought to be searching for all manner of ways to aid the dissidents and the protesters in Iran. But instead, it's signaling in repeated ways just the opposite.
It's shameful. And the fact that it is continuing now with the help of these outside and very diabolical forces is the more shameful. Robert, let me pivot to a matter closer at home. You have been tracking at jihadwatch.org, among other things, what's happening at our southern border, or what used to be called our southern border. Of note is something that you reported on, which I had not seen anyplace else, namely that this administration is not only seemingly doing everything they can to disable and demoralize our Border Patrol agents who have sworn to protect that southern border and our Constitution in the process, but they are seemingly now further undermining their desire to serve by force-feeding them this sort of Black Lives Matter agitprop, as you call it. Define that term for us, and what on earth is going on here?
Agitprop is an old Soviet term, meaning agitation and propaganda. That is, it's designed to give the masses the line that they are to take and to stir them up to action upon it in service of the communist regime. This is essentially what the Biden administration is doing in distributing this anti-police Black Lives Matter material to the Border Patrol. It's, in, as you noted, trying to demoralize them to signal that the administration is not on their side, is not with them in trying to fight against the border being out of control, and is trying to inculcate among even the Border Patrol the idea that the Border Patrol itself is illegitimate. And I'm sure they would be very pleased if, as a result of distributing this material, there were mass resignations within the department.
Well, and unfortunately, this seems of a piece with what they've been doing in other agencies, including the United States military. This demoralization, ideological purges, vaccine mandates, and the like have seemed to have, at least as one of their predictable upshots, you know, a reduction in the number of people who are currently serving being willing to do so, and the opportunity to replace them with people who may have a very different attitude towards, among other things, our country.
Exactly.
Our Constitution. Should we be concerned about that too?
Yeah, they want to clear the patriots out of the Border Patrol, out of the military, fill it with malleable people who are there understanding that what they need to do is just whatever the government tells them to do and only follow orders, as of course we've heard that phrase in the past.
We have, and it's not been a pretty picture. I have the feeling that we could go on and talk about the FBI, what's being done to that cohort, the intelligence community as well, all in keeping with this weaponization of those agencies against the American people. Robert Spencer, your insights as well as your running commentary on all of these matters is invaluable. Thank you for the great work you do at jihadwatch.org. I hope all of you will check it out and that you'll be back to us soon. Robert, in the meantime, stay well. I hope the rest of you will be back to us again next time for more of Securing America. Until then, go forth and multiply.